Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Leah Rothstein, co-author of Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. This book, which she co-authored with her father, Richard Rothstein, is a follow-up to his critically acclaimed book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Leah holds a master's degree in public policy from UC Berkeley and has worked on public policy and community change from the grassroots to the halls of government. She specializes in community development and affordable housing policy practice and finance. Leah's expertise across the full range of housing policy stems from more than two decades as a community and union organizer and a consultant to housing developers, cities and counties, redevelopment agencies, and private firms. Listeners can join this conversation by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Leah.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with why you and your father co-wrote this book.
Sure. Well, he wrote The Color of Law in 2017, and that book really challenged this notion we have in this country of why we are segregated in our communities, why all metropolitan areas are segregated by race. We tell ourselves it's a form of de facto segregation that is not a result of government policies, but is a result of personal preferences or just private actors. And so he wrote The Color of Law in 2017 to debunk that myth that he showed with, you know, fact after fact from history that the segregation of our communities was created intentionally by government policy. And those government policies were in violation of the Constitution.
Quick question. When you say we tell ourselves, who is the we in that?
Well, I think all of us sort of have adopted this notion. I remember, you know, when I was in high school, in my history textbook, there was maybe one sentence about residential segregation, and that was defining what de facto segregation meant. And so I think it's perpetuated in all ways, all sorts of ways, through education, through how we talk about communities. But at the time that these government policies were enacted, it was very explicit. It wasn't the government, you know, wasn't trying to pretend that they weren't taking actions to racially segregate communities. They were very explicit, racially explicit policies. But since then, we've sort of forgotten how that happened. And so we've come to accept this notion, many people in this country, that segregation happened because, you know, we sort of self-sort into same race neighborhoods. We like to live around people who look like us, or it's a question of economics, or it's, you know, private actors, bigoted landlords or realtors that created segregated communities. But what my dad showed in The Color of Law was that those private actors, you know, they had a role to play, but their actions were required by government or incentivized or explicitly required through government action to ensure that communities, as they grew and developed, grew on a segregated basis, and that segregation was maintained. So, you know, a lot of people read The Color of Law. It sort of struck a chord. It came out in 2017. And a lot of people who read it and listened to my dad talk about it were, you know, their eyes were open to all of the ways that the government created segregation. And once you hear that and understand, well, you know, we don't necessarily want our communities to be segregated, and it happened in this unconstitutional fashion, so we have an obligation, a responsibility, a role to play in undoing it. But what do we do? So a lot of people ask my dad that question. You know, I understand this history now, but what can we do to change it? And he eventually decided he had an obligation to answer that question. So he got me to work with him, bring my housing policy background with his historical knowledge to write a book to answer that question. What can we do now to challenge segregation in our communities?
That's a really good intro, and I appreciate that background. You mentioned something that I want to touch on before I ask you more about your background and how that contributed to this new book, Just Action. Mm-hmm. But what you mentioned was, we forgot. And before you said we forgot, you said the government was explicit in its role. It was explicit in the racial covenants. It was explicit in the public policies and the laws. So everything was out in the open and well known. How did we go from a generation of people who absolutely understood by law, by public policy, by private sector practices, what they were doing to sustain a policy of racial segregation. How do we get from that to a generation who didn't understand and had no idea how the conditions that they inherited got that way?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll give one example, and I have several, so I could give more if you'd like. But one to start is around zoning. So we hear a lot these days, if you're paying attention to housing talk, about zoning, residential zoning, and that zoning is, you know, how a city decides what can be built where, what neighborhoods can have commercial uses, industrial land uses, or residential uses. And then it used to be that cities zoned their residential areas by race. So this was explicit in their zoning codes, saying this neighborhood is zoned to allow whites to live. This area is zoned to allow African Americans to live in this area. So again, explicit policy written into zoning codes in cities across the country to establish where different races could live based on land use laws. At some point that became unconstitutional. The Supreme Court found that unconstitutional. It was a violation of private property rights to be able to sell your home to whoever you want. And so we could no longer zone by race. So those cities who had white zoned areas and wanted to maintain the whiteness of those areas zoned those residential areas to only allow single family homes. Now, if you only allow one home per lot in a neighborhood, it ensures that the homes in that neighborhood remain expensive. As demand increases for homes in those areas, the only thing that can happen is the prices can rise because you can't increase the amount of homes that can be built there to meet demand because the zoning code, single family only zoning, limits how many homes can be built. So when you keep the homes in those whiter areas expensive, it ensures that only those families or households with more wealth can afford to live there. And because of other government policies enacted prior to this, white families have more access to intergenerational wealth than African-American families. And so through that zoning history, we have used the zoning code first explicitly and then more implicitly to create and maintain segregation. So people who weren't around for the time when we had explicitly racial zoning might not know that there's a racial motivation or history behind what they think is just a zoning code that maintains the nice single family only character of their neighborhood, right? But it's more than just the aesthetics of the neighborhood, the zoning history of most of those suburban or subdivisions, suburban areas. It has a more racially explicit history, and it's been sort of covered up or become less explicit over time, but that doesn't change the nature of how it came to be and why our neighborhoods look the way they do today.
My guest is Leah Rothstein, co-author of Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. Leah, to your point, we're all born into a chapter of American history and inherited these inequitable conditions that none of us created. But the information you and your dad provide just isn't known or taught in the public schools. So what role do schools play in the process of empowering younger generations with an understanding of the racialized inequitable conditions that persist in housing, healthcare, and even in education itself?
Yeah, schools have a huge role to play. And there are, you know, curriculums have been developed based on The Color of Law and other similar books that show the, the racialized history of our country. And so there are some students who are learning that. And, you know, to your point, those of us who grew up when those kind of curricula weren't in place in our schools, we are the ones who forgot this history. And so it's up to those of us educating the younger generations to ensure that we no longer forget, that we re-remember the true history of how our country came to look the way it does. That can happen through schools, that can happen at home, that can happen through other community groups, religious organizations, you know, any sort of way that we're interacting with our neighbors and our families and our communities are places where these conversations can happen.
Well, when I talk about zoning laws and regional economic development strategies and planning in my own region, there seems to be a pervasive lack of interest in even how these high-impact decisions are being made at the local level. How do you elevate not just the awareness, but the interest among a population that just seems content because they're beneficiaries of the status quo?
Well, I would say, first of all, that The Color of Law has sold over 1 million copies, so there's a lot of interest in the history. You know, we had 20 million people turn out for Black Lives Matter demonstrations in 2020 after George Floyd's murder. So there's interest in this country. It's just not necessarily tapped into. A lot of people, you know, turned out for Black Lives Matter demonstrations at that time in 2020 and then came home and put lawn signs on their front lawns or, you know, maybe read a book, maybe started a book club and then didn't do anything further. And so we believe that there's a kind of untapped potential to generate this interest and action around these ideas. We have to just have these conversations. So that's one way to answer the question. And then the other piece is, I think it's true that many people are comfortable in their communities and don't see these issues impacting them, and so don't have an interest because we're self-interested people in this country to a large extent. But, you know, not everybody is so self-interested. And this the same trends and actions and strategies that created segregation, like the single-family only zoning example that I gave earlier, have led us to an affordable housing crisis that is now felt by communities all across the country because we haven't built enough homes to meet the demand. Part of the reasons we haven't built enough homes is because of suburban, higher opportunity areas wanting to remain exclusive and keep others out of those areas by not building enough homes for them to be able to afford. So these are sort of like, parallel strategies that have led us to this moment. And the affordable housing crisis is touching all communities today. So even those who are comfortable in their single family homes, middle income, upper income neighborhoods, they're feeling the reach of the affordable housing crisis as well. Teachers can't afford to live in their communities. Their kids don't have stable teachers in their classrooms because they keep moving because they can't afford to live there. Firefighters, police officers, other first responders can't afford to live in those communities. Their own children can't afford to come back and buy a home in their communities. So we all are affected by these exclusionary policies. We're all ultimately impacted to our detriment by these policies. And people in all kinds of communities are starting to recognize that and feel that. And that's what we kind of need to have those conversations more with people who think that they aren't being affected by this.
Well, we have about a couple of minutes before we have to take a break. The Color of Law gave a historical perspective to our current conditions across housing, racial segregation, and economics, as you alluded to. But Just Action, your new book, seems to be more of a playbook on how we can take action to change these conditions that we inherited. How has your own experience working in public policy shaped that perspective?
Well, my own experience working in public policy showed me, you know, that there are policies out there that communities are implementing that can have an impact on these issues. I think it's easy for those not in public policy realms to think that these kinds of housing policies are too boring, too complex, for them to understand or be involved in. Leave it to the experts. Policy wonks care about this. Regular people shouldn't. But what I found in my experience with public policy and community organizing and writing this book is that these policies, they aren't rocket science. They aren't that complex. If you can explain them in simple terms, people understand them and they can make the connections and understand how those policies impact their own lives and their own communities and start to see how they can have an impact on that and start to engage in that process. And, you know, from working within government, I know that government wants local community input and involvement in government policies. There's, you know, a lot of times people who are opposed to changes in zoning or to building low-income or multifamily housing in their communities, they're the ones who show up at city council meetings and planning commission meetings because they, I believe, operate out of fear. They're afraid that their lives will be
Hold impacted. That thought. Hold that thought because I want to come back to it. We need to take a short break. My guest is Leah Rothstein, co-author of Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Leah Rothstein, co-author of Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. Leah holds a master's degree in public policy from UC Berkeley and has worked on public policy and community change from grassroots to government. And before the break, Leah was alluding to NIMBYism and fear. Leah?
Yeah, right. So NIMBYism, not in my backyard. These are folks, you know, the term NIMBY has been used to describe people who oppose, they might support general, you know, ideas about housing affordability or housing access, but when an affordable development or a multifamily development or any denser housing is proposed in their neighborhood, including zoning changes, they turn out in opposition to those changes. And I believe they often operate, they're motivated by fear. They believe that these changes will hurt them, hurt their property values, negatively impact their neighborhoods. Now, a lot of these beliefs are unfounded. Property values don't fall when new affordable housing is built in a neighborhood. Neighborhood conditions don't change. Oftentimes, people don't even notice the development after it's built. But that doesn't, negate that people are operating out of fear. They come out. They're vocal. Their opposition is felt by local elected officials. Now, we believe that there's just as much support for these kinds of changes in zoning and new affordable housing and access to housing in neighborhoods. People who support it, they're not as motivated because they're not afraid. They might sort of passively support these ideas. They don't come out to the meetings to express their support for these developments. And the future residents of those developments aren't yet identified, so they can't come out to support those. But I believe, and I've talked to a lot of local elected officials and communities all over the country who support these kinds of increases in housing production and density in their neighborhoods, but they need some cover of support from their constituents to be able to oppose the opposers, you know, to go against the loud NIMBYs. So we need to build that support, the supporters of affordable housing and zoning changes, to be just as loud and just as vocal and just as consistent in showing up in their support for these developments to their city council people and planning commission meetings. And again, this starts by us just talking to our neighbors. It doesn't start with a big, you know, march or demonstration or action at city council. It starts by your neighbor, you know, knows that there's a housing development proposed and they might be saying all these negative ideas and myths about what will happen to their neighborhood if that is built in down the street. And we can start to counter those beliefs with our own experiences and our own support for a more accessible, inclusive, diverse neighborhood.
Well, let's address two points that you made. One is affordability. Let's get into what does that actually mean? And the second is when you talk about more inclusive, more diverse, are we saying, and I just want to be clear, are we saying that the NIMBYism crowd is primarily a white, affluent crowd?
Generally, yes. There have been studies showing who shows up at local planning commission and city council meetings to oppose housing developments, and it's often older white homeowners. It's not always the case, but generally that's what we see. Those are the people who have time to show up to meetings and who live in more affluent neighborhoods that tend to be more single family only properties. And so they are worried about the changes that any more dense housing will bring to their neighborhood.
So the idea of affordability bringing people in who can afford to live in an affluent neighborhood, the NIMBYism crowd doesn't like that.
Yeah, historically, they don't. They have ideas about who lives in affordable housing or lower income housing.
Stereotypical ideas?
Stereotypical ideas, racialized stereotypes. You know, when people say they're worried about the character of their neighborhood being negatively impacted, you know, that's a thinly veiled, I would say, racial motivation, racially exclusionary motivation. You know, I'm not saying all NIMBYs have the same motivation, but generally that is what they're alluding to, is bringing in lower income people of color into their neighborhood will often, you know, some of these arguments are crime will increase, overcrowding in the neighborhood will increase. That doesn't happen when these developments are built, but that's sort of the prejudices, the stereotypes people have of low-income housing and who lives in those housing.
And when we use the words low income and affordability, what does that mean? In real terms, yeah. in data?
Sure, yeah, that's a great question. So I like to say that there's a capital A affordable housing and a lowercase a affordable housing. The capital A affordable housing is what's defined by the federal government or local government. These are projects funded with public subsidies, and they have very specific definitions of what affordable housing is. It's based on a household paying no more than 30% of their income towards their rent and using income limits. So low income, very low income, moderate income are all defined based on percentages of a local area's median income. So you take the median, the middle income of a whole metropolitan or county area of the spread of all of the incomes, and then a percentage of that defines what a low income or a very low income or moderate income unit is. Now, in some areas, that capital A affordable housing still isn't affordable to very low income families, because when it's based on a median, there's going to be some people, you know, half of the people are far below that median. That's one way of defining it. There's also sort of a more broad way of defining affordable housing, which is just housing that people can afford. And we need more of that too. We need both of these kinds of affordable housing. And one way to get that, it's also called naturally occurring affordable housing, not needing public subsidies, but it's just more affordable based on maybe their smaller sized units or their smaller lots, or they have less high-end amenities, and so the homes are just more affordable. And those are units that are often, you know, affordable to middle-income families who make too much to qualify for subsidized low-income developments. And by changing zoning, which I keep coming back to, if we change zoning in single-family-only neighborhoods, one of the goals and often the outcomes is that more of this naturally occurring affordable housing is produced, because when you have a lot that used to only allow one large house, that house is going to be expensive. But if you can change the zoning to now allow that lot to have four units on it, then those units will be less expensive because they're smaller, they're, you know, less high end, and so they're more affordable to a broader range of families and households.
My guest is Leah Rothstein, co-author of Just Action: How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. To your point, Leah, building more homes is something we need. And there are people on the opposite side of that who don't want that. But when I look at the Federal Reserve information data, it tells me that their total, the whole housing inventory stock in America, is 146 million units. And when it breaks it down, 75% of those 146 million homes across the country are owned by white Americans, which only leaves 25% for the entire rest of non-white America. If we build more homes, won't 75% of white people still own those homes?
Likely, yes. They will still outbid the rest of the country because they have, again, more access to wealth because they've owned homes in the past, or their parents or grandparents have. due to government policy that helped them own those homes in the past and prohibited others from being able to own homes. So again, this is, you know, a result of historical explicit action by the government. So yes, the first step is building more homes. We need more homes. We can't solve this problem without having more homes available. And then we need additional steps to ensure that we are, you know, taking steps and implementing strategies to close that racial homeownership gap. Down payment assistance programs for first-time homebuyers, first-generation homebuyers, or even racially explicit down payment assistance programs that go to African-American homebuyers, for example, as a remedy to the policies of the past that prohibited their parents and grandparents from being able to own homes. So zoning is just the first step to addressing this problem, increasing the number of homes available. And then there's many, many more actions and strategies we need to be thinking about if we're truly concerned with redressing segregation, closing the racial home ownership gap, closing the racial wealth gap. And Just Action, our book, has dozens of policy strategy ideas of what local community groups and local communities can adopt to begin to untangle this and to challenge segregation. No one strategy or policy will solve it on its own.
But under the political climate that we live today, where there's this notion of colorblind ideology, which has never existed in this country, but now the implementation of a colorblind ideology in policy suggests that those who are already dominant will remain dominant, and the conditions that provide benefits to the dominant culture will continue. And so how do we address that when the policies from the very top level of our government are now rooted in this 20th century racialized segregationist ideology?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a difficult moment right now, for sure, to see the way forward in all of this. But I will say that, you know, there's a lot obviously happening on the federal level, so much it's meant to overwhelm and stop us in our tracks. But what's happening on that level doesn't stop what local communities are doing to redress segregation, to increase housing access, to increase housing production. I've been speaking about this book around the country in all kinds of communities for the last couple of years, including since the election and since the inauguration of Trump. And communities are still committed to these strategies and these aims. And I think we have to stay the course. And there might be setbacks based on this administration. But, you know, so far, the local efforts on zoning reform, down payment assistance, those aren't under threat, unless we take those federal actions to mean that we should be intimidated and stop what we're doing. And I don't believe that that's the correct way forward. There are always setbacks. The civil rights movement didn't just, happen and win victories without having major setbacks along the way. And so I believe, have to have the fortitude to keep working on these issues. And now, you know, more than ever, it's important to focus locally where we can have an impact and where our efforts will have an effect.
Okay, we have about 1 minute left. Tell me about property taxes. They're a big piece of the puzzle too, right?
They are a big piece of the puzzle. And this is a little known issue, is that property taxes, which seem like a racially neutral, program or policy, that people are taxed, everybody has the same percentage tax on their property, but it actually has a racially disparate outcome, which means that whites are generally across the country underpaying in property taxes relative to African Americans. You know, these are homeowners, obviously holding the value of their homes constant. Whites are paying less than African American homeowners in property taxes. We don't have time to get into the intricacies of that, but on average across the country, African-American homeowners are overpaying to the tune of 10 to 13% in property taxes. Now, when you're overpaying in property taxes, you can't build as much wealth in your home ownership experience as if you're underpaying, you know, because more of your monthly payments go towards property taxes. This is, again, a locally controlled issue by property county tax assessors. Yeah. And a way to solve it is for local groups to start to look into property tax bills and how assessments are done. The reason for the disparity is based on how home values are assessed on a countywide level.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for writing this book, Leah.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest was Leah Rothstein, co-author of Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law.